Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The historian Charles King knew what a lot of us know about George Frideric Handel's oratorio, The Messiah, that it's maybe the greatest piece of participatory art ever created, that its theme of Jesus's prophetic birth and resurrection draws thousands and thousands of believers and non-believers to see and hear it performed around this holiday season. King says people say they find something in the Messiah, something true and intimate and magnetic, and that's certainly how he felt about it. But then he heard the Messiah in a different way. This was a while back, in the middle of what he says turned out to be the worst few years people can remember, the COVID-19 pandemic, the insurrection on January 6th. He and his wife Maggie live in D.C., so they aren't far from Capitol Hill. And in a new book, King says they felt hemmed in by what seemed like a dark future. So he was looking for something to let in a little healing light.
And a few years earlier, I had purchased for Maggie for Valentine's Day one of these old phonographs, a VV50, a Victrola. And I thought, what if I could find the oldest recording of Handel's Messiah, which is a piece of music that we loved, and Maggie is a singer and a writer herself. And I thought, if I could find this ancient recording, I'll put it on this ancient device, and then somehow the world will be set aright. And I did what anybody would do, which is go to eBay looking for this thing, and found a seller in London and bought this 1927 recording. So we put the record on. There's a kind of overture that moves from a minor key to a major key. And the violins kind of rock back and forth for a while. And then they stop. And there's this lone, high tenor voice.
Comfort ye.
Comfort ye. Comfort ye, my people. We just burst into tears, the two of us. You think of how the earliest audiences would have experienced this as they're hearing this piece of music. The first thing that's announced to them is that it's going to be all right. Things are going to be okay. And you're going to go through a lot of turmoil. There's going to be a lot of suffering in what comes in this story. But let's start with the idea of the world turning out all right. I mean, the kind of staggering possibility that things might turn out for the better. And that was exactly the thing we needed to hear in that moment. Then that made me realize that, in fact, the reason generation after generation has felt Messiah to be kind of eternally present, like something written for their moment, is because it contains within it an entire philosophy of living. It's not just a piece of music. It's a kind of guidebook to a better world. the first words you hear are, comfort ye, my people. And the comfort ye in the original biblical text, the prophet is not saying, you people in a time of trouble and turmoil, be comforted. It's an injunction. It's a command to the listener not to be comforted, but to do the comforting. And I thought, oh my God, the piece of music is saying the route out of despair, the route out of desperation and trouble is for you to chart the path. You be the one to comfort other people. And I thought that was just such a brilliant and meaningful thing that, you know, we keep discovering new layers to this work of art.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Charles King's book is called Every Valley, and it's about those other layers to Handel's Messiah. It's about the creation of the now famous oratorio, how it works, how strange it is, and how this collection of basically cut and pasted scriptures from the Bible reenacts the human predicament. Outside of just the promise of comfort, King says it's also a gritty, relatable account of everyday hardship. And he told us it wasn't just him and Maggie. The Messiah makes a lot of people burst into tears.
People experience it really very personally, and that might be for religious reasons. You know, for believing Christians, it's the entire essence of their faith. It's the story of the birth and the suffering and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But even without the theological dimensions, I think the texts that it is based on, drawn from the Hebrew prophets and from the Psalms and from the epistles of the New Testament, from the book of Revelation. These things are kind of foundational to Western civilization and culture. These are ancient words in the King James Bible translation, this early 17th century language that just feels like the language of something important, you know. And I think even in a very secular age, those words still have a kind of resonance and power to them, you know. And so you go to any performance of this piece of music, and this is, I think, probably a rarity in the classical canon. You go to any performance and you'll look around and someone will be tearing up, or someone a couple of, you know, rows over will be weeping. And then, of course, because it's been around for so long and it's so intimately associated now with the Christmas season, it recalls, I think, some set of family connections. You know, maybe this is a thing you went to with your parents as a child, or your best friend really loved it and they're sadly no longer with you. So I think we imbue it with all of these personal associations in addition to just the power of the text and music.
One of the things you write about is that you wanted to, you say in the book, sort of understand that deeper Messiah, right? And, you know, like how it was created, and how it was created by more than just Handel, of course. You mentioned creators. That's important, and we'll get to the other creator. But the other thing that's interesting is you said you wanted to also connect it to a time and a place.
Yeah.
Talk about that, because the book really gives us a sense of the world, and in particular 18th century Britain.
Yeah, so it's born in early 18th century Britain, and it's born in the early stages of, you know, what we now call the Enlightenment. Yeah. But I wanted to tell a story of the Enlightenment as most people actually experienced it, and that means going into the shadowy corners of the 18th century. We think of that period and narrate that history as being about, you know, advances in science and new theories of government and reason and rationality. But to most of the people who lived through that time, all of that would have come as this sort of great surprise in a way. Britain is at war at the time that Messiah premieres. It is an expanding empire that's defending its territory against other rapacious empires. It's a time of disease and of children abandoned to their fate, and a period when women had no civil existence in the state if they happened to be married. At this time in London, for example, the infant mortality rate is 75%. Yeah. That's an astonishing figure. But every family, every couple who had children and attended a Messiah performance, they would bury more children than they ever saw to adulthood. And so when they went to a performance hearing about suffering and a text that asks whether there's any point in suffering at all. I mean, what's the meaning of life, you know, in the biggest possible sense, but even more deeply, what's the meaning of all of the bad things that happen in this world? Why do the nations so furiously rage together? The text asks at one point. Why do the people imagine a vain thing? Death, where is thy sting? Grave, where is thy victory? I mean, these wonderful biblical texts that are wrapped around arias and choruses. People could kind of feel the immediacy of that, I think. And so I wanted to tell the story of the Enlightenment not as, you know, this time of the triumph of reason, but as an era in which people were trying to figure out how do you manage catastrophe. Mm-hmm. So that if there is a kind of advance that we make collectively in the 18th century, it's not that we all suddenly become reasonable. I mean, in England, in Scotland, in those versions of the Enlightenment, people understood that emotion is a hugely important part of how people behave and how they make decisions and so forth. The great task of the moment was coming up with ever more creative ways of managing disaster in the world. And at the core of that is the concept of hope, that hope is the thing that keeps you afloat. You know, hope was always represented in the art of the period by an anchor in paintings and cartoons and so forth. Hope is that sort of anchoring idea that keeps you grounded, literally grounded on some very tempestuous seas. And so to me, you know, the art, music, literature, cartoons, theater of the Enlightenment are a really critical component of trying to understand this time of world historical importance, not just the philosophical treatises that were written in this age.
So one of the things you write about is Handel, where he fits in all of this. He's born in, not born in Britain, of course. He's German by birth, born in 1685, in, as you describe it, the long shadow of conflicts over religion and territory. So I'm sure he could, when he was born, could connect to that tumult that you were mentioning there as well. Yeah. And his father is a physician, a barber surgeon, I think is how they described it in those days. Yeah. And I guess it was expected, as you say, that Handel would follow his father into that business. But as you say, his interests run in a very different direction. About his – I guess he was born to music. Is that right to say?
Well, I mean, which is the even more interesting part of the story, I think. I mean, the person who is Handel's exact contemporary, Bach, was born to music. So Bach was, you know, kind of deposited almost at the same time, about 100 miles away, into a family of already very, very well-established, accomplished musicians. And Handel wasn't, though. And interestingly, the two men never met, even though they were exact contemporaries. Handel's father, as you say, was a barber surgeon, as it was called at the time. He was connected to a local notable family, but he himself was in some ways an employee or even a servant of those families. He ran a tavern on the side, and then he was also a public health official on the side, meaning that part of his job was to kind of cordon off areas of Halle, the town where Handel grew up when typhus or the plague was raging. And the obvious thing for Handel would have been to kind of step up the family fortune, you know, to go into the law or another profession. But he was a kid who just from a very early age seemed to love music. Yeah. And there's a story that when he was very young, he somehow acquired a clavichord, which is a little kind of practice harpsichord, and went up to his attic room and would practice on it in secret. I've always thought that story was a little suspicious because I don't think anybody practices an instrument in secret, right, in a house, no matter how big the house is. But it kind of showed this kid who just loved sound and loved what sound could do. And his father, to his great credit, arranged for organ lessons for him with a local church organist. And Handel really took to it. I mean, he had incredible talent from early on. But sort of beyond that, he had sort of the critical ingredient of, you know, artistic achievement, which is just a burning desire to do it.
So it wasn't that he was just a virtuoso or that they could see that he had the sort of raw talent, but he also had a kind of ambition, drive. Yeah?
Yeah, he had that. And I think, you know, this is a kind of thing that then had a huge impact on the rest of his career, because we have to understand this musical period, you know, which we now label the Baroque, right, but neither Handel nor anyone else knew they were in a thing called the Baroque period. And it was this wild, improvisational, rule-breaking time. You know, we kind of look back on it and imagine it with, you know, people with sort of wigs and frilly shirts and the entire thing. But, you know, even the word Baroque is a later term that's given by classical era composers to this period that was seen as being a bit over the top, you know, a bit kind of unruly and wild. So it's closer to like the words punk or grunge than it is to anything else. And so for a young man in his late teens and early 20s, that era just felt like it was magical, especially in Italy, which is the place that Handel will eventually go, you know, to sort of cut his musical teeth. Things are being invented at this incredible pace. I mean, literally new musical instruments, such as the piano, is sort of emerging in this period. But all of these musical forms, you know, concertos and sonatas and cantatas, and it's, you know, it's for a reason that we kind of break into pidgin Italian when we're talking about music.
Well,
because, you know, the Italians are inventing all of this, and it's wildly, wildly just fascinating and enthusiastic, and it's just magnetic for Handel, I think.
Well, then he comes to London in his 30s. Rising from that experience there in Italy to make his way, as you describe, among the rowdy theater world of Britain. It was theatrical warfare going on that played out on stage that was also a reflection of the kind of political pandemonium, in Milton's term, I guess, that was playing out. Talk about that, because that seemed really dramatic and intense.
Yeah. So, I mean, Handel sort of first came to London. He's, you know, he's a working musician by this stage. He spent several years in Italy kind of perfecting his craft. He's made a name for himself as a performer and as a composer. But he's looking for jobs wherever he can find them. You know, he will take a position with a wealthy patron, but then there are also theaters that might be willing to hire him. And London is increasingly becoming a center for this. It's on its way to becoming the largest city in Europe. This is right at the time of the thing that will become the West End, or London's theater district, is really getting up and running. And there's a huge enthusiasm for this new form, this new musical form, Italian opera, you know, with crazy plots and mistaken identities and sorceresses and dragons, and then this virtuosic music that is being imported along with virtuosic musicians from the continent. And Handel arrives into the middle of this as a really amazing practitioner and begins to help to transform the kind of musical life of the city. But, you know, at the same time, through a complete accident of history, his employer back in the German lands, an individual called the Duke of Braunschweig-Lüneburg, becomes George I of England through these sort of crazy dynastic machinations that will ensure that there is a Protestant on the British throne. George I comes to London, is crowned in 1714, and then Handel at that stage becomes not only a theater composer, but also the court composer to the new so-called Hanoverian line of British kings. So that means that even at still a relatively young age, Handel is pretty solidly on his way to becoming the most important public composer in Britain.
Charles King, he's a professor of international affairs and government at Georgetown University. His book is called Every Valley: The Desperate Lives and Troubled Times That Made Handel's Messiah. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling the backstory to Handel's Messiah. And it wasn't just Handel's Messiah, by the way. The words were created by a tormented soul who cut and pasted sacred scriptures into a performance of the reality of life, anguish and joy. Handel, of course, put it all to music. Charles King says the Messiah is a set of meditations on the proper way to see the human predicament. The book is called Every Valley. So we know it as Handel's Messiah, but of course it wasn't just Handel's Messiah. Let's talk about the other creator, Charles Jennens. He is, as you describe him, an emotionally tormented human being. By his own reckoning, puny. Introduce us to Charles Jennens.
Yeah, so Jennens is, you know, really the heart of Every Valley in some ways. I mean, I begin the book with him. He is a terribly unsung figure, very obscure to most people, but he is the person who is in some ways the truest father of Messiah. He was born extremely wealthy to one of the wealthiest families in Britain at the time, but he suffered from a thing that in the 18th century was called the HIP, yeah. H-Y-P. You know, that was short for hypochondria, but that word didn't mean a kind of imaginary ailment. At the time, it meant, in the kind of medical philosophy of the time, the male equivalent of hysteria in women. But in men, it was thought to manifest itself as what we might now call chronic depression, or perhaps even bipolar disorder. And you can see in Jennens's letters, and we have more than 100 of them that have survived, you can kind of see when he's in a kind of manic episode and super creative, you know, and then in these really, really dark periods where he calls himself a wretch repeatedly, and in writing to a friend says, these are times when I can imagine just doing nothing with my life, you know, having no project, no action of my life that I want to try to pursue. The one thing that seemed to kind of pull him out of this was art and music.
Yeah.
You know, he ended up being one of the most important art collectors of the time, also probably the most important music collector of the time, sort of collecting original manuscripts, sort of sheet music from people all across Europe, in fact. And kind of at the core of that set of obsessions was Handel himself. He was, you know, a Handel super fan. And every single season, he would go to every concert, every new opera that Handel had on offer. And the two of them then eventually became friends, not the closest of friends, right, but we're certainly on very friendly terms.
Well, and of course, what becomes the Messiah is deeply, deeply personal for Jennens. I mean, you mentioned he builds this private sanctuary filled with, as you say, evidence of what could be rather than what usually was. And so he would turn to this art and these objects in these dark moments. And he has this dark moment, a troubled season, as you say in the book, where he starts to pull down books from his library shelves and he starts to pore over them, copying down these quotations from sacred scriptures, and he's putting them together, and then he's rearranging them and moving them around and then tying them together. Take us through this. What's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, Jennings was a believing Christian, and he was a very high church Anglican, which meant that he was very different in lots of ways from Handel. Handel was kind of religious in the normal sort of Protestant way, but not particularly devout. And it wasn't until much later in his life that he evinced any kind of, you know, deep sort of religious belief. But Jennings was, and he was so high church in a way that he was convinced that any attempt to kind of rationalize Christianity was doomed to failure, that Christianity, kind of like monarchy, rested on this ineffable sense of wonder and awe and majesty. And if you took that out of religion, somehow you were denuding it of all of the stuff that made it important and made it real in people's lives. And so he found in the sacred texts this balm, in a way, for, I think, both his own depression as well as a kind of clarion call to this particular way of seeing the Christian faith, that putting awe and majesty and wonder and mystery at the core of the Christian experience. And at some point, probably in 1739, 1740, maybe into early 41, we don't know exactly, he takes texts from the King James Version of the Bible, you know, which is a little more than a century old at this stage, not quite a century and a half old. And so the words are both ancient as well as fresher in a way than they would be for us. And he starts writing down texts from throughout the Bible, from the Hebrew scriptures as well as the New Testament. But then he does this rather odd thing. He rearranges all of them. So when you hear a performance of Messiah today, nothing is in the biblical order. You know, you are hearing Jennings's ordering of the text. It's what he wants. It's the story that he wants to tell you based on the raw material of the Bible, from, you know, comfort ye at the beginning to the 3-minute long amen at the end. That is all Jennings's work. And you can almost imagine him, you know, with all these Bible verses on sheets of paper, kind of, you know, moving them around like index cards on a big library table. And then he writes all of this up. He divides it into three parts or acts. We think there's probably an indication of what he wanted a chorus to be and what he wanted a song or an aria to be. And then he ships that all off to Handel, we think, without Handel's knowing that he was doing any of this. Jennings called it a scripture collection.
Yeah.
And sent it off to Handel, and then had really no idea what happened to it. It may have sat on Handel's desk for months, maybe even a year or more. And it's not until August and September of 1741 that Handel finally begins to turn to this very odd text.
And you say the heart of that very strange concoction of scripture was, as you say, not so much a statement of faith as a test of will. That's how you put it. That it was this affirmation of something he himself, you say, had always found hard to believe in. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, think about how this thing begins again. So the first words are, comfort ye, my people, in that sort of half-sung, half-spoken recitative. This is from the 40th chapter of the book of Isaiah that Jennings is sort of, you know, furiously kind of copying down. And if you think about what the text is actually saying, it's beginning with this idea that, you know, everything is going to be okay. The disorder of the world as you see it now is ephemeral. that is actually going to pass away. Comfort ye my people. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished. Her iniquity is pardoned. Those are the first sung words in this thing. And then you go into this song that says the world as you see it now is completely opposite to a rightly ordered world. A rightly ordered world is going to seem so radically different from the one that we experience. So in that rightly ordered world, every valley shall be exalted. Every mountain and hill are going to be made low. The crooked is going to be made straight. The rough places are going to be made plain. And when you think about the context of this, in this warring, difficult, tumultuous 18th century, or indeed if we think about what's going on in Jennings' own heart, where in this depressed state, every piece of evidence that you see in the world seems to confirm that you have reason to be depressed. But Jennings is telling himself and he's telling us through the medium of this biblical text that actually, what if I started out with the assurance that the world as I experience it is not the world as it might yet be? That the world as it might yet be is the opposite of the thing I see outside my front door. And so he begins with that kind of assurance. And it's almost like a changed philosophy of life, you know, rather than looking at all of the reasons to despair and then numbering them up. What if you began with an assurance? You began with the staggering possibility that things might be okay, and then worked back to kind of make the world into that thing. That, to me, is kind of the essence of Enlightenment era hope. It's the idea that the world can actually be turned on its head and made better, that the world as we experience it doesn't have to stay that way. And of course, Jennings is doing this through the prism of his own faith. But I think, you know, even in a much more secular age, that's a radical vision of how to be more hopeful about the world.
Charles King, he's the author of Every Valley, The Desperate Lives and Troubled Times That Made Handel's Messiah. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. The crooked straight and the rough places. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Charles King. We're talking about his book, Every Valley, The Desperate Lives and Troubled Times That Made Handel's Messiah. Handel's actual score for The Messiah is still around. It survived. But Jennings' original pages for the libretto, they were lost. But there are these copies of the early word books, I guess they're called.
Yeah.
And you include one in the book itself at the end.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about that because it's such a – like if you took out the music, what difference does it make to just see the words?
Well, I really wanted to kind of include that text as an appendix to Every Valley because, well, I wanted Jennings in a way to get his due.
Yeah.
I mean, Handel and Jennings are the George and Ira Gershwin of the 18th century, you know? And it's the person who wrote the book or the libretto for this and the person who wrote the music. They're both essential to creating this thing. But we only have one real piece of evidence about what Jennings actually intended in the original version of Messiah. And that is the so-called word book, or it's kind of like a playbill, I guess. You know, it was a thing you could buy when you went to a performance that would have the entire text or libretto of Messiah. So you could follow along with the words as the soloists and choir were performing. The first version of this from 1742 had loads and loads of printer's errors in it. And then we think that Jennings corrected the one for 1743 that was used in the first London performance the next year. But I have to tell you, there is only one copy of this left in the world. And it is at the Morgan Library in New York. I actually saw it not too long ago for the first time. I'd seen facsimiles of it. But to then be in the presence of the closest thing to Jennings' original intent that we have, you know, in New York, having seen the original Handel manuscript in London, I felt like I'd come full circle.
Say something about that first performance of Messiah. It wasn't performed, as you said, in London. It was performed in London, in Dublin, and at a music hall on, what is it, Fishamble Street?
On Fishamble Street.
Yeah, Fishamble Street. Right. I mean, it seems like we have these grand notions of what it must have been like. But what was it actually like?
Well, that's right. And I mean, you know, it did not have auspicious beginnings. And that, to me, is like so much more of an interesting story in a way. Because of the place that Messiah has in our culture and civilization now, you know, we want it to be the product of a lone genius with the angel on his shoulder committing this act of devotion, and then we want it to debut in Westminster Abbey. And none of that is true. Handel really didn't think of this as particularly important. He was on deadline because he had a series of concerts that he was going to do in Dublin. Why Dublin, you ask? Well, because he had an invitation to do a series of performances there, and his reputation was beginning to slip a little bit in London. And when he accepted to, you know, to make really an arduous journey, and he's aging, and he's had a bout of paralysis not too long before, all of his friends are like, you know, why are you going on this trip, and why would you possibly endanger your health? And from, you know, the perspective of Londoners, why are you going to the provinces, as they might have thought? So in August and September of 1741, he completes the writing of the kind of draft manuscript of Messiah, gives it to his copyist to fill out, gets on the short run packet boat across the Irish Sea to Dublin, where he's going to stage a series of kind of greatest hits concerts that fall and into the spring. And if things go well, he might even stay around until the summer. And as the spring is rolling around and the Easter season is rolling around, he had already thought that Jennings's text would make a good thing to perform then. It is, after all, really an Easter story, you know, because without the birth and resurrection of Jesus Christ, you don't get Christianity. So Messiah is fundamentally an Easter story. And that's, we think, how Jennings kind of intended it. But already that fall, when Jennings arrived in London, as he normally would, he was just flabbergasted, first of all, to find Handel not there, which means that he would have no Handel performances to go to for that season. But he was really angry. He said, he told a friend, it's with some mortification that I arrived in town to learn that instead of performing my scripture collection here in London, Handel had gone into Ireland with it. And for a fair amount of this period, Jennings has really no idea what Handel's going to do with this thing. He really didn't know until he arrived in London that Handel even set the thing to music. So Handel schedules this for the Easter season, 1742, and he's putting together musicians kind of wherever he can find them. He uses the band of the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, the sort of viceroy of the British king. They're very accomplished musicians, but they're kind of the equivalent of a military band, if you like. He's got choristers from Christchurch Cathedral and from St. Patrick's Cathedral. He's drafted in a soloist, at least one soloist from abroad, some local Irish singers. There's a woman from London who's not a great singer, but is a really good actress named Susanna Cibber, who happens to be in Dublin. And he puts all of them together, does one rehearsal, which turns out also to be a public rehearsal to try to gin up interest in this new and untried piece of music. And then on April 13th, 1742, this thing premieres in Neil's Music Hall on Fishamble Street in Dublin. And, you know, it is not at all the kind of beginning to this thing that you would imagine. But we know from a few eyewitness accounts of people who were there that people were very affected by this. In fact, there was an Irish bishop who attended who said that the really surprising thing, beyond this being a kind of species of music like unlike any other, the really surprising thing is that people were quiet during the performance. And that in an 18th century context was really astonishing, because theaters were really, really loud places. It's a place you would go to see friends and, you know, maybe have something to eat or bring food of your own. And then you might be quiet if there was a wonderful, you know, aria being performed by a star on stage. And then you'd go back to your conversation. But throughout Messiah, people seem to be really quite well behaved and taking in, you know, the message as Jennings had intended it and the music that Handel had written for it.
Well, you say in the book that those earliest audiences were often divided, you say, on whether what they had just seen and heard was magnificent or kind of unnerving or somehow both. Like, explain those different reactions. It was new, so they wondered what to make of it, I guess. But also there was something that it was reaching that seemed maybe original and different.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's, you know, unusual to have a piece of music sort of drawn from the styles of Italian opera, but composed entirely of sacred words, you know. And of course, in a much more sort of publicly religious age, everyone would have sort of understood the text that they were hearing, and they would have been most familiar with hearing that text inside a church, right? Not in a secular theater or music hall. So there was this sense that this was a rather strange piece of music, very affecting, very moving, in part because of, at that first performance, what was also happening on stage, because one of the soloists, Susanna Cibber, was renowned, or notorious is perhaps a better word, notorious already in 1742, not because of her talent on the stage, but because of her private life. She had been an up-and-coming actress in London, but had married very poorly, as it turns out, to this sort of rakish figure named Theophilus Cibber, who contracted a series of triadic relationships between himself and another man and his wife, mainly to pay his gambling debts and his bar tab. So she was horribly abused by this husband, fell in love with one of these men, we think, perhaps on the promise that he would rescue her, as he in a way does. This individual, William Sloper, and Susanna Cibber maintain a relationship then for the rest of their lives. But Theophilus sued her lover for alienation of affection. There was no reason to divorce his wife, because Theophilus thought, well, I can just keep suing William Sloper over and over and over again, so long as he's having an affair with my wife. But what it meant to take Sloper to court was that the most intimate details of the private life of Susanna Cibber, the deepest sexual details of her life, were going to be aired in court, as they were in 1738 and 39. And she was then a laughingstock. I mean, people took down the transcript, and it was so salacious that printers printed it. People wanted to buy it. They accompanied it with, you know, pornographic cartoons. Her life on the stage was absolutely ruined. And it was simply by chance that she turned up in Dublin to restart her career on the stage outside London at exactly the time that Handel was there to do his own kind of restart. And he cast her in the premiere of Messiah. Not only did he cast her, but he gave her that magnificent aria, "He was despised, rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief." That's the kind of deepest point of the story of the Passion of Christ in Messiah. Being sung by a woman, the private life of whom everyone in the audience knew from the newspapers, from these salacious pamphlets and so forth. She was absolutely notorious and ruined, and everyone could do the gender switch for themselves in the audience. You know, she was despised. She was rejected. She was a person of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And that you can imagine the scene of that. Not only is the text about the sort of the suffering of the Savior of the world at the hands of humanity, but it's being sung by this woman who is a breathing, living example of how base humans can be to each other. It was miraculous and moving. And I think that was one of the things that helped to make the reputation of this piece of music, the sense that not only are you experiencing a text and experiencing music, but that somehow, that text, that music, this thing together, this work of art, somehow does something in the world. It connects to the world of your own immediate experience.
And it's nice to know that after the performance, her reputation, as you mentioned, was no longer defined by that public scandal. She basically was able to kind of reclaim her life.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really make this up. Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible historical moment because she stays around in Dublin. She's performing in other things there at other theaters. But then when she makes her way back to London, she's on the same boat with David Garrick, who is the most important actor of the time. And she and Garrick start up a professional relationship such that she becomes really the most important stage actress of the middle and later part of the 18th century. Wow. And the fact that her redemption begins with this piece of music that's itself about redemption is just astonishing.
You mentioned how performances of the Messiah have come to take on this really grand scale. They become monster performances, is how you describe it. And as you say, Handel probably would have loved it. You know, the bigger the better, I think, in some ways for him, right? But what do you think of it? Is it how, as you reflect on your experience with you and your wife listening to a much more sort of toned down version of it, what's the best version of the Messiah to be able to really understand what Jennings and Handel were getting at?
Well, I think the best version of Messiah is the one that you really hear, you know, the one you pay attention to. And of course, now there's a real enthusiasm for what's sometimes called historically informed performance, where, you know, you might do it on period instruments and with a choir or an orchestra that's structured in the way that it would have been in the Baroque period. And those are really, really magnificent. And kind of hearing it in a more intimate way is great. But hearing it with a massive, massive choir and a massive symphonic orchestra booming in that, you know, in that way it would have been performed in the, say, middle of the 20th century in a more popular way, that's also fabulous. I think the key thing is really to listen to the music. It's, you know, so well known, so popular, especially around the holiday season, that it can kind of float in the background. But once you start digging into the words, you know, you're experiencing a musical journey of one man's engagement with his faith, yes, but also one man's attempt to communicate to all of us across the centuries something really profound. And that is, you know, a radically new way of thinking about your own life, thinking about your own day, your own week. Mm-hmm. Start with the concept of hope and then kind of work backwards from there. You know, Jennings put all of that down on paper. Handel turned it into music, and this incredible collaboration of two people who were very unlike each other has given us one of the great monuments to the possibility of a better world.
Charles King, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
Charles King, he's a professor of international affairs and government at Georgetown University. His new book is Every Valley: The Desperate Lives and Troubled Times That Made Handel's Messiah. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.